Africans at home and throughout the diaspora. Unity is strength. We've got the power.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now's the time to do the right thing.
We need more unity. Come.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now's the time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of Umoja, embrace with love.
Let's do it right now. We've got to do it right. Stop the fussing and the
right
fighting.
Right now,
now's the time to do the right thing.
So we're going to redo this. We're starting all over again. Sorry for any interruption and inconvenience. This is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield. And we are live streaming on Facebook. We are still not in our studio with the Black Radio Hall of Fame, but soon, I heard, soon, or as the Jamaicans say, soon come. This is a reminder that this is the show where we bring folks together who are fighting on various battlefields, connecting those struggles so that we know we are not isolated, that we are fighting against common enemies for common causes with common values. It's not always common tactics, but that's where the discussion and struggle comes in. Also a reminder that we still have a 34 count felon in the White House, a pathological liar, and he and his minions are aiding and abetting a serial predator, sexual predator. And we came out last weekend to say, this is not what we want. This is not the kind of democracy that we want, and we're going to fight for it. So 7 million plus folks came out all across the country, in every state, blue states, red states, if you want to categorize them that way, rural, suburban, you know, we couldn't even fathom how many was in Missouri alone. And so we felt very comfortable that, you know, it was probably double the amount of people who wanted to attend but couldn't just because of various reasons. So I think the fact that those numbers are growing and that people are getting mobilized and organized to resist is very, very important. However, we know that it's not just about protest. And I over the weekend, I had one of the international media outlets contact me to say, where did I think the No Kings March should go? And I think you all know I have plenty to say about that, but I'm going to talk to our guest about that as well to see what his views are. But here we are. There's lots of things going on, you all, and I'm going to say some of them now. I might repeat them later if we have time, but I want you to zero in on two petitions. One of them is the People Not Politicians petition. That is the petition that we are gathering signatures for because of the illegal gerrymandering map that the Republicans just passed. So that completely is going to wipe out the only Black congressperson on the Kansas City side. So this is going to be statewide and we need to pay attention. They have created a map. I want y'all to listen to this. Kansas City is on the far western side of the state. It's like East St. Louis. It buttresses itself against another state. So they have redrawn a map that takes that urban district of Kansas City all the way to mid-state Missouri. So if you look at the map, and I hope you can, it's available online, you see this whole swath and you wonder what kind of district could that possibly be? Well, I'm gonna tell you what kind of district it could possibly be. It is one to eliminate the only Black congressperson on the western side of the state and to give the Republicans another seat so that they can win at midterm. So this is all very calculated, which is why we need to be paying attention. If somebody comes to you with People Not Politicians petition, please sign. You have to be a registered voter in Missouri. So please sign. The other petition, which is not based on voters, is based on people who are about justice. There's a group of us, including the Organization for Black Struggle and some other groups who have been involved in wrongful convictions, are gathering signatures to help the new state AG, which is, you know, Hanaway, because this is an office that for the last, I know for the last 30 years, because that's how long I've been dealing with wrongful convictions, they have resisted and countered every person, black, white, male, or female, whose case came up before them. Now, you would think this would not be their mission, and it is not. So we have to remind them of their mission. So that is on the internet. It's an online petition, sign that. And then on Monday, there are three things going on at the same time, y'all. I just hate to do this to you, but you can pick one. On the 27th, which is Monday, almost at the same time, What's Happening with Black Women in the Workforce, that is a community piece where some of us women who've been involved in labor organizing are coming together to, it's been a series of webinars over the last several months that we want to highlight women's role in the workplace, in labor movement, and in labor organizing. And this time is about what's happening with Black women in the workforce. And we know, we saw the numbers of Black women that were kicked out by Trump and his MAGA minions. And now that the government shut down, those women, another round of women, are also adversely affected. So it's real and it's painful. The other thing that's happening on Monday is a book event. And you will recall that I had Jonathan Pulpus and Stefan Bradley on the show talking about their books. Well, Stefan is a professor. He was at SLU when it was happening. And Jonathan was one of his students. Well, Jonathan went on to graduate with a degree in Black Studies. And he wrote the book. His book just came out. And I think it's very important for some of the organizers and activists from Ferguson Uprising to write about those experiences so that we can see that phenomenon from very various angles. So he is asking me to join him on the panel on Monday at St. Louis University Pius Library, and that's gonna be at 5:30. So hopefully you can join us. The other thing that's happening is there on October 27th on PBS, which is public broadcasting, which has taken a hit from the MAGA folks in terms of funding. And we'll be talking about that more in a minute. Percy Green, our civil rights icon here locally, a documentary on his life, Man of Action, will air at 7 p.m. So there was a screening a couple of weeks ago. There's going to be another screening on Saturday at 7:30 p.m. It's outdoors, y'all. It might be a little nippy, but you need to bring your chairs, bring your blankets, because you know Kena Plaza is outdoors. But that's at 7:30. So those are some things that you should be aware of so that we can make some things happen and also to build more unity. I now want to introduce my guest, my very special guest, Guillaume Pereira. And I would say that, you know, the first thing I'm going to tell you about is his official formal kind of things, but then I'm going to get into what he really does. So he's a senior fellow with the Philanthropic Initiative for Racial Equality, which we call PRE. He also co-directs the newly formed Center for Applied Research on Democracy, and he's a principal at Portobello Advisor. So that sounds all fluffy, right? This brother has been organized, and this is where we come together as movement soulmates, because we've been almost the same path, except I'm a generation ahead of him, and I never let him forget that. Honor your elders. So he has been organizing in student, labor, community, and electoral politics for decades, as have I. And he has also been an executive director, as have I. And I don't know about you, Guillaume, but that is not a role that I really relish. I'm an organizer at heart. I'm a strategist at heart. So that's where my love is. But we've done both of those. The only thing that I haven't done that Guillaume has is he had the chance, somebody trusted him with money at the Ford Foundation. And I'm sure he gave it away, as would I if I was in that position, because I believe you don't need to be accumulating wealth, you need to be sharing it. So we've done that, and we met many years ago when he was the executive director at Miami Workers Center, and which I think we should have a whole show about that, Gihan, because I think to organize Caribbean, Caribbean workers, Black workers, Latino workers into a formidable united front fighting for workers' rights, it's got to be a story to be told. But then you took that to scale with Florida Rising Majority, which then became a statewide group that was doing the same thing, building power for working class people. So lots of intersections here, Gihan, but welcome to Voices from the Battlefield.
Well, I will start by saying, when you call, I come. I know my place in the generational line here, and so when Mama Jamala calls, you show up, and so I'm here to really honored actually to be here with you. And it's for me a way to, as we were talking even in prepping, just how do we actually reconcile our experience both generationally and in movement with this current moment, right? And just talking it out and building the threads across was just really important to say, are we seeing the same things, over time? So I'm really—
And let me just say, for just because you said that, I think it's critical for us to acknowledge the intergenerational relationship, because oftentimes people want to negate that, but it's the continuity, it's the sharing of experiences, this the discussing of the political analysis that helps strengthen our movement and the relationships that are going to move us forward. And so I've never negated that. I always, open myself to young people, and as have you. And as we grow older, now we're in a different part of our lives, different phase of our lives, which calls for different responsibilities, and I'm trying to lean into that as an elder and as a movement mama, but I still value what young people are bringing, and it's so powerful if they get acknowledged and if they come into a space where it can actually be shared and integrated in ways that I think benefit all of us. So yeah, thanks for bringing that up.
Can I say, just to be honest, can I say one more thing on that actually?
Sure.
I mean, as you and I were talking, I was extremely privileged to be schooled by elders in the movement. I consider myself lucky to be open to it. Sometimes it wasn't whether I was open to it or not. I still got schooled, and and I'm grateful to the elders that knuckled me on the head even when I didn't want it and thought I was an upstart organizer. I had the benefit of actually having liberation traditions handed down to me and like being actually schooled in them. So I know that my own experience, I experience myself within those traditions. And I think a lot of what we're dealing with today is that there's a generational break in the experience of, do you still see yourself within the arc of those traditions and having benefited from it and being accountable to it, right? And I just think particularly, I was just reading a bunch about and just what's happening in the New York electoral race and Black voters and the generational experience in the generational divide that's there. And I think if I look broadly, we assume in the movement now that people coming up have a sense of their connection to social movements that were from the 60s and before. And people, and I'm finding a ton of people just don't have that. They don't relate to it in the same way. They don't see themselves as part of it in the same way. They don't have the same frameworks. And so, and feel disconnected. I mean, not just from the movements, but from everything. And so so what we have come from that is really special. And then how do we deal with the fact that a ton of people don't see themselves in that, right? It's not the starting point of their assumption, even on things like race and civil rights. And, we don't see the mass backlash against things that we think are important Right, we would think everybody thinks is important, but it's because I think people don't have that inner, they've not, we've, they're not within that intergenerational arc.
And why do you think that is?
I think, I mean, just talking about me and you, I feel like I was lucky to be introduced to elders, specifically just in movement, that took people took me under their wing and schooled me, and I was introduced relationally to people that I wouldn't have been otherwise. And I think there was a moment where that sort of keep hand, like where you were brought in into eldership, that became very thin. And it was almost like a whole generation of folks came up in movement where that wasn't a thing. And they didn't have that connection. It wasn't, and it, you know, wasn't, it didn't, wasn't necessarily valued, but there was no structural way to offer it either. A lot of the elders, I mean, just thinking about it now, a lot of the elders that I met were in political organizations, but they not, may not have been in paid organizations. And most of the people, this is part of what we've been talking about in the last 20, 30 years, that, the non-profitization of the movement really grew. And people sort of had their political life in their nonprofits. And so there may, there were some real elders in those nonprofit organizations, but it was, you had to be an ED to be an elder, to be a mentor that way. Not all of us were able to do that movement leader ED thing, right? And so I just think that then there were, there are some real mentors who are nonprofit leaders, but that's not the whole of the movement, right? And so how do you, like all of our intergenerational training started going through a nonprofit filter in a way.
And we'll talk about that more, but I just want to underscore what you said because I feel the same privilege of having been taken under wings of people like Amiri Yamina Baraka. I was in the Congress of African People. That's where I got my cut my teeth on organizing. And so there was a pathway, there was an ecosystem, there was a movement that was shaping and molding folks if they wanted to be shaped and molded. And it seems to me over time, and I attributed this to the weakening of the US left, particularly the Black left, that started to crumble. So even 20 years, 10 years ago, when there was a Ferguson uprising and you had all these young people coming into the fore, there was literally very few people there to sort of take them in. So in many ways, yeah, I don't call them out for not like recognizing that because they didn't know what they didn't know. They came thinking, I want to do something, I'm mad, I want, and there was nobody to say, here's how you do that. Here's the best way to do that. Here's the most strategic way to do that. It just wasn't there. And so I think in the absence of that, people sort of then put their own stuff together. They talk with a peer and say, this sounds good. And they move on it. And I think, when we look at where we are now and really trying to build a resistance movement to fascism, we see that there's lots of gaps and lots of work to be done. But let's start with what you just mentioned in terms of how the nonprofit industrial complex has really enveloped the way that people see the movement now, particularly the younger generations, and sometimes make it synonymous with, like a radical or revolutionary organization without looking at the fact that those nonprofits have boards that are tied to funders that are tied to corporations. And so your ability to be unfettered, to be bold in action and words are going to be mitigated. You're going to be muffled because of that. And when we were at, and you were here in St. Louis, was that last year or this year? Jeez, time is going by fast. Anyway, we were there talking with funders, progressive funders who are anxious about this moment. So, let's for you, for somebody that's in both worlds, what is it looking like now for progressive organizations whose funding is being challenged in many ways? We've seen the decimation of the DEI programs and politics is almost, they've almost criminalized it, particularly in the academic world. And people are anxious. You know, the funders that were in the room with us, they were anxious about what could happen to their funding. And so kind of paint the picture for people who are trying to figure out what the landscape looks like now.
Yeah, so let me do two things. One is this non-profitization question, then I'll say like what I see happening now. You know, it's interesting, even, and I really appreciate the way that you describe all the young people who came in, right? They just came in wanting to do something. And even for me, you know, I had the privilege of being schooled by elders, and like really had my accountability around that. And for me, when I became an ED, the accountability to those elders and that movement, because at the same time, like the actual movement and structures of it sort of dissipated at the same time, the rise of being a nonprofit executive director. And when I look back, like I actually missed having the accountability of something that was beyond my nonprofit business that I had to be the director of. Right. And there's a different role and structure politically of being accountable to movement than it is to like having to ensure the well-being of the nonprofit. And so not that you can't do both, but those are two different things.
And they also could end up being two conflicting things.
They can. And what I realized for myself is how do you navigate those conflicts, right? Which doesn't mean that, you know, you don't need to have an apparatus that can raise money and, you know, and actually be able to have resources. But that, where's your accountability? Where do you get the insight from? I kept getting that from peers, but it was, you know, over that time, you know, as I became an ED, I felt like that became my primary purpose was being an ED and keeping the apparatus running, and raising the money and getting the programs to and dealing with HR issues and then liability issues. And then like all of the business side of the stuff, which like you were saying, wasn't why I got in it to be an organizer and strategy, you know, the ideas and vision. And so I think that's a real thing. And just, it took so, you know, and that was, it was hard for me to do that part of it and to reconcile those conflicts and figure out how to do it. And then what was my own ego and being an ED in my organization, even though if I had movement aspirations, like how do I actually hold the type of accountability without getting sucked into this role I was in now, right? And you see that everywhere, all types of things, but without an organization that's beyond that one thing and an accountability to it, it was very hard to navigate that, even if you want to be principled and do that. And I just think that what my reflection on that now, and I work with a lot of organizations, mostly at the state level now, and there's really been a conflation between the political organization and the apparatus of the vehicle, whether it be that nonprofit or something, right? So that and in most cases, the apparatus sometimes becomes more important than the original political purpose of the thing. And I think in these times, the question is really coming back up to folks, because if your nonprofit gets attacked and your resources get attacked, will there still be an organization there if your vehicle gets disrupted or you know, your funding gets cut, or you know, it gets attacked for one reason or another, your nonprofit tax status gets attacked or your grants get reduced, then is there still an organization there? And I think that's something that over the last 20, 30 years, people didn't have to face. It's kind of one and the same. And so that's a big question that's coming up now for folks, is like, okay, what does our organization look like? What do our members and leaders still do? How do we still operate if the attacks come on our nonprofit status or our funding or funders? And I think that's in some ways it's a good question, because it's not one we want to have to face, but it's one that we are having to face potentially. And you know, it is over our lifetime, right, over the generations that we've been involved, that this thing has actually happened, the both the non-profitization of the movement and the professionalization of the movement that goes with it. So what will we do if that, if those things get, you know, over course history, unseparated again? And what does it mean to build voluntary political organizations? What forms and other things do we take if these tax vehicles don't become the same things that they've been? And if you know, on your second question of then what's actually happening, what's happening in philanthropy and in nonprofits is very much in line with what's happened with higher education and cultural institutions, et cetera. The Trump administration recently put out a executive memorandum that says that the Department of Justice will investigate liberal groups, starting with Soros Foundation, and that those groups will be essentially, and this first came out after immigration protests, and then more recently that foundations could be investigated for supporting what is then called criminalized activities.
Everybody's Antifa now, so yeah.
Right. So basically, it's, you know, it's using the national security state to, you know, name everything that's against the agenda as domestic terrorists, right? It's case. So it's not just tax exempt status, but it's also criminalizing them in a particular way. And what's also is, you know, just like in higher ed, you go over after one big target. So Soros has long been a nuisance and target of the right. And so it's not a surprise that the Soros Foundation is like the first big target. But the premise there, right, is to dismantle and destroy the infrastructure, right, of where progressive thought and organization move. And so the, you know, that is happening now, and we'll see how it plays out over time, right? But what they're indicating, you know, and it's happening again with high profile targets like the Soros Foundation. And it, of course, causes a shudder in the entire sector, right? Where all the philanthropy's trying to say, like, what we do. And there's a big questions there about how much they stand up versus try and hide in the bushes to see if this goes away. And of course, there's many leaders in the philanthropy who are saying, you know, if you sort of disappear in advance, you've actually, one, you're not going to save yourself, and two, you've already sort of capitulated to before we even had a fight. And so there's moves to sort of for philanthropy to stand in solidarity. The real question is, one, about what? Is it just their freedom to give, or is it actually standing on the agenda of justice and racial justice, et cetera? Right? Would you actually stand on the agenda versus just your First Amendment right to be able to give out your money? And then secondly, it's, you know, how are groups responding to that? And I think a lot of the groups are responding to look down the line and say, okay, how do we rethink our organization and our forms and our resources? In the event that this happens, how do we keep being effective? And I would say the biggest thing of that comes to something you and I agree about is, well, where is your organizing, right? Because if everything else disappears, you have durable power and your members and your leaders will keep organizing even if the formal organization goes through changes. And I saw that at the Worker Center because after I left, the organization went through significant financial fallout, right? Which often happens, especially when the first ED leaves and they have some transition. And it was really amazing to see that in those crises, which at some point got pretty thin about whether things going to last or not, regardless of what happened with the staff or the money, members kept meeting, organizing. They had a space that they, you know, that was one thing that I had left was like they still had a building,
yep,
space,
yeah,
and all of those leaders kept doing what they always do because they weren't paid anyway, right? They had to figure out how to get there. They had to, you know, they had a place to meet. But it was clear to me that set of leaders and their network and that community organized regardless of what happens to the incorporated organization, right? And then it made it through. And I think that's going to be the question at large, right? Like, how durable is your leadership and your membership? And we'll see how much will the staff who've been accustomed to be professional paid organizers or whatever role, will people, how many of what people will continue to do the work through these disruptions, right? If you, it's not just your job, how will we keep the work moving and how many people will continue to do it and what will that take? And I think
that's a critical question though, Gihan. And I think as some people are pondering it, as they see how the landscape is changing, what are you seeing? Are you seeing people then jump from the nonprofit movement space to maybe the nonprofit, I would say the mainstream nonprofit, like, you know, those folks that they think may be more resilient from the attacks because they seem to be non-threatening. I think that, you know, we haven't thought enough about that. And when I look at some of the organizations, and I've been acknowledging this observation for some time now, and that is that there is very little organizing of the working class, which for some organizations, that's central to their mission. And so if you haven't been doing that, if you haven't been dealing with building leaders from the working class, I think you are going to have a problem with that durability, with that viability, because now you got a bunch of individuals who now are seeking another job, and that's all it is. And so as we see some of those fractures beginning to happen, what are some of the things that we could be looking at and helping people understand better that it's going to be more optimum for us to be together than apart? And I know that it's easy for people to say, hey, you know, my nonprofit, I got to make sure it survives, kind of like what you were saying. And, you know, I know other people going through the same thing, but this is what my primary thing is right now. And so what I've seen is people do stuff like, you know, they may have had a particular component of their programming cut. And so then they do a GoFundMe, like, help us, you know, keep this, or this is what happened. And I'm thinking, geez, we can't all be doing GoFundMe. That's unsustainable. Like, what are we going to do collectively if we're all getting ready to go through the same, if not similar, attacks that we can resist? And I think, it seems like it's hard for people to think in that way, that collectively we have a better chance than individually. But I think some people think that their own individuality is what got them where they are, and that they'll figure this out on their own. And that to me is going to be the downfall of some of us.
You know, just on that last point, right? I mean, this is a bunch of the stuff that we're trying to look at with this new center on applied research on democracy. You know, view of your individual way out, it is part and parcel of what neoliberalism has produced.
Exactly.
And we're so in it now that we're swimming in the water, so we don't know we're in that water, right? But like, your default, because of your experience you came from, is a collective solution, right? But you flash forward 60 years of neoliberalism, people don't have the experience where collective solutions are the thing that deliver them and that they could be accountable and count on, right? Because we don't have the organizations which deliver that in the same ways, whether not just left organizations, trade unions, all, you know what I mean? Like the dissemination, the destruction of all of that stuff that was the fabric of collective common life, including like democratic apparatuses. Right, neoliberalism has really wrecked all of that and the experience of it, right? So everybody's experience is, if I want a good education, I gotta do that myself. I can't count on a good public education. I can't count on a, you know, at work, I can't necessarily count that my trade union is the go-to, right? Like, just in all of these different places in life, people's mind frame is the individual, right? It's just, it's, it is what we have to, something we have to confront. Second, I think biggest thing that I learned, because I freaked out so many times every time we got to a funding thing, I was like, oh my God, what's going to happen with that? What's the staff?
Yeah, because now you're responsible for families. You know, 100%. that's a hell of a thing to be thinking about every time you wake up every or go to bed at night.
Yeah, and people that you brought in, that you like, all of that, right? And so, you know, if I could have done it then, I would have. The biggest thing is like, don't freak out.
That's harder to say.
You're like, don't, because I freaked out when I thought about that. I would freak out and I'd like react and wanting to preserve, hold on, right? And I couldn't think how we will survive and how will we survive? How do we keep the mission going? That may mean a lot of different things, right? Even for the big foundations, you know, I was talking to somebody saying, well, what happens if that? And they were like, well, look, Mark Zuckerberg doesn't even have a tax status on his foundation. They pay taxes on him, and then they do what they want to do, right? And so I was like, what? And he was like, yeah, you know, it's just, then you pay the tax, and then you're privately, it's your private capital that you distribute the way that you want. So there's always options once you get past the freak out thing to figure out, okay, now in these conditions, what do we do? How do we raise resources? Because we always have. How do we figure out new ways to work? Because we always have. How do we found out better forms? Because we always will. Now, I'm not saying that'll be easy and that's just what we do. It's just the main thing I'm saying, if we don't freak out, we can figure out how to adapt.
Yeah, you could take a sobering look at what needs to be done and who to align yourself with initially and build out. So what do you see are some of the obstacles to doing that? Because, yeah, we know, and this is what I keep hearing, particularly from Black people who say, you know, I'm not going to be freaked out about all this stuff. We've been through this hard times before. We survived. We have, but at what cost? I mean, I don't think we are whole people in 2025. So what are we losing through all of these, like, psychological, financial, physical fights that we are having to go through, which this one to me is very different from anything. I mean, this president is different from any president we've ever had. So we can't always say, oh, we've done this before. We've done it before in different ways, but I don't know, given the fact that the checks and balances that once were in place have now been dismantled. I'm talking about the court, the executive branch, and even the legislative branch. So what's left is only us. And what I've called the fourth branch of government is the people. That's what I said. Now it's time for us to, like, step it up. So what do you see us, and we talked about this movement reset as we were talking about this show. What does that look like, and what are the obstacles for us, like, getting together? And when I say getting together, I'm not talking about, like, this sort of kumbaya moment. I'm saying, like, there's got to be a critical mass of us coming together to think our way out of this.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad you're raising this. You know, it's interesting because, well, I'll take just a thing that a friend of yours said that I was talking to across the way in your fair city. I was talking to Bethany over at Deaconess, and we were talking about, like, what's the Black response to this moment? And there's this whole thing, like you were mentioning, about, okay, well, just line dance and sip cappuccinos or whatever, like is it just that you've seen this all happen before, let them do what they're going to do? And then, you know, Bethany was saying that it seems like the alternatives are everybody go on the street today and out, or sit back and sit out. And what she was saying is there's some of us that will need to be out there right now, but there's also a way of building resilience and for this thing to go that's not just sitting it out, right? And I just think, like, so if there is a reset thinking to be done, there's new forms of organizing that needs to be done, new forms of organization that need to be built, right? And I also think there's significant rethinking of who's in movement and how do we get these people who don't see themselves in the traditions, even our folks, see themselves in automatically in the traditions, right? And so, like, my mom went to the No Kings March. She was telling me all about it, blah, blah, blah. And then, but she was also like, do you know what? It was mostly old white people there and just white people in union, you know, like she was naming that it was like the traditional older generation Democratic coalition, essentially, that was there. So a whole bunch of folks who don't see themselves in our movement, right? And they may or may not. So we'll have some people that see themselves and are clear about, you know, No Kings or whatever other framing, but there's other people who are just disillusioned from this whole thing, don't feel like there's any potential for power and are checked out. And so how do we bring, what do we got to do to bring those folks in? What's the type of things that gets them in? How do we, you know, leverage those folks? You know, I was on a call earlier today and it was really heavy because there was a bunch of folks who's work with folks whose SNAP benefits are about to run out. And, you know, a lot of the clinics and service organizations that service them used to not be involved politically at all. They're kind of just at their service. But both their organizations and their constituents are about to be, like, really out right now.
Material. Yeah, absolutely.
So, like, what and how do we reach those constituencies who have a real material interest now in what, like are directly being impacted? And what's the way to talk to them? How do we reach them? How do they feel, like, what's the combination of our organizing tactics that actually deal with their material reality and bring them into something that they actually could relate to? I think those are organizing questions that we have to figure out. And then who are the folks that will be people we didn't imagine before as political social movement actors that we need to, like, recognize and bring in? You know, I mean, we've already seen a bunch of, you know, the attorneys who've been really important who aren't movement attorneys, just a bunch of attorneys. And there's a whole legal sector of folks who've got activated in this. But what are the other sectors on our side that, if we're going to build a really big united front, big is that? And how do we get to all of these people that are disillusioned, right? That's what we're trying to figure out, people who are checked out. And that we used to automatically assume would just roll with us and are just sitting on the sideline, right? Like, how do we reach those people, involve them, activate them, get involved? I think for the, you know, and I think there's a lot of people in nonprofits, some that are sort of just overwhelmed with what's happening. And then there's some that are trying to figure out how to pivot, right? So they're... Mm-hmm. Practically, they're doing things like starting LLCs and, looking to way to diversify their funding and resources. They're getting ready, right? And so that, and then second, and what to do about their staffing. And then there's people who are thinking much, you know, who are really thinking about really broadening who they're talking to, right? And that's a challenge because we're used to talking to people who agree with us, even when we're trying to build a united front. So, like, how broad do we have to go, and where do we need to figure out where to start something big enough?
Gihans, it seems to me that part of however we respond has to start with a shared political analysis of this moment. And I don't think we have that as a movement. And because of that, then people are doing things that are not going to be effective. And I think that leads to more disillusionment because you bring people along and say, da-da-da-da-da, this is what's going to happen. And then nothing happens. And then you say, what the did you have me doing this for? So I think it's just critical for us to not necessarily pause, because some of this stuff we got to be doing simultaneously, but to really look at what this moment means. And some of us believe, fascism is coming. We've seen the tendencies of this administration, and people to the point, some of the points you raised earlier about, I'm going to sit this through, you know, we're going to get over this. The damage that's being done now, it's going to take decades for us to get, unless we sort of be more decisive. So, for example, this fool is tearing down the East Wing of the White House to build a mall. Okay, some people might say, I don't give a F what he does with that White House. But I caution people to think about, that's what's happening to your house, brother, sister, man. That's what's happening. They are tearing down our house. And so everything that this man is doing, he's doing it with our money. He's getting ready to pay himself $230 million for legal fees. Self that. So all of this is our money. We are going to be penniless, broke, looking at each other, mad and angry. And he's going to be sitting in Mar-a-Lago doing his thing and have enriched himself tenfold with our money. So think about our money and our house is tearing, being torn down, and maybe that will motivate somebody. But I do think the analysis piece is critical right now.
I wholly agree with you, and I would go back to something you said earlier. Starts for me is analysis of what's happening with the working class. Like, what is the actual consciousness? What's happening with the working class? Because I think, you know, we've lost our bead on it, I would say. And how do we actually get that bead back to actually do working class organizing that's effective? And you know, I mean, that's like the number one thing to me. Like, how do we rebuild the base of working class people that are in motion? Feeling good. And then the second thing about it is, you know, I think this question of moment is it now? And we have the, you know, the president himself, which is a phenomenon, as you talked about. And then there's the whole movement around it. Right. And that, and then so how do we understand the entire phenomena so that we could actually act in ways that are effective? And I do think it does take some thinking to think about, okay, because I see is if we don't do that thinking, even when we act right into their playbook. They run a pick and roll, and we just keep smacking into the screen and thinking that we did our job, and they keep just running up the score. So, like, how do we not just fall into their playbook? And it's the adaptation that we need to do to be able to actually build.
So I think, you know, that is a question before us, because out of that analysis comes the strategy and also the tactics that we'll use in this particular moment. And what I always tell my listeners is that the three things that we have, still have, that we need not give up without a big fight, and that is our voice, our dollar, and our vote. Now, all of those are about to be challenged, because it's almost going to be criminal now for us to even assemble, let alone free speech. Forget that. So, how are we looking at the now, but also the worst case scenario that you pointed out? Like, what happens if there's no money? What happens if you don't have internet? What happens if they shut down that little phone that you've been communicating with and you've been calling yourself organizer with? The what ifs, I don't think we really have taken that seriously, but these folks are making us think about it in ways that I think we haven't. And so in the few moments that we have left, can we leave our listeners with some positive actions and thinking that we could be doing over this next period? Because we're getting ready to in many ways start planning for midterms, and some people think it's something magical that's going to happen there. But some people say there may not even be a midterm, because this man might declare himself the king for real, and there's nothing that probably will stop him from doing that. So what should we be thinking about in the next 3, 6, 9 months, year, that we think will make a difference for the next 5 to 10 years?
Let me give you 3 points of hope. How about that?
Okay.
Right? I mean, one, while all this is happening, you know, I'm really fascinated by the Zohran Mamdani race in New York, both as the fact that you know, a democratic socialist, but a social, you know, someone who's been called out as being socialist and everything else is going to largely have a huge win in the mayoral election. Now, there's a whole bunch of questions there, but The appetite for that while all this is happening is really fascinating. And what does that mean for the potential of politics, including and in how it shapes up with Black people and Black voters around his, around being mayor. Second, but it's the fact that it's happening right now is a thing, right, for us to all look at. And I know there's a Hammer and Hope article that just came out about that. Second, even in Minneapolis, I just heard about there's a group of people who used to be professional staff of nonprofits and organizers who've built a free association of something called the Free Radicals that are just helping organize things, right? They're figuring out work and everything else, but they're not letting the fact that they are displaced from their nonprofit stop them from organizing. So I think more and more things like that, don't let your job status be the thing that defines your activity level. Right, keep figuring out how to organize and build, and even if it's outside of the ways that we're used to it now. And then third, I just heard of there's some Discord group of like 4,000 or 5,000 artists and cultural workers were really trying to strategize on this movement reset, right? And they weren't even in my radar. I didn't know nothing like that existed because I used to looking at, I'm only have a certain landscape of things I'm looking at. I think there are people doing things and adapting, and we have to find each other, right? I'm now trying to find who those folks are and bring them together with you and the folks in Minneapolis and these folks. How do we actually start bringing the people who are adapting together to actually lift up what's happening and share, here's how to do it.
I think that's a good note to end on, because one of the things I always say at the beginning of the show is we're trying to connect people so that we don't feel isolated, because sometimes we think we're the only ones involved in a particular fight. And then we look up and say, oh, wow, they're doing the same, a similar thing there, or they're facing a similar thing. So I think the way that we look at the world is easy for us to feel isolated, because that's the game. You can't win. Nobody else is doing it. Nobody's listening to you. And that's absolutely not the case. And so I think we have to keep pushing on, but pushing on in strategic ways that are going to empower us so that we win. We got to have some victories. We got to have some victories. So I want to thank you, Gihan. We got to do this again, because I think in several months we might have a better feel for how this thing is going to shape up. And you got a couple of conferences that you are going to be speaking at, or helping to like get the thinking of people around some of these important issues. And so I think we just need to keep having the discussions, pointing to people who are doing the proactive work, and seeing how we can stay connected and support them even when we can't be connected. So thank you for being here today.
I will end with what I started with. Just a great pleasure to be with you, Jamala. And I just really appreciate our relationship over all this time. And all of the people that brought you in, that brought me in, and that brought us together, and that we can we do that as we go through this for other people. So I just appreciate being on.
Absolutely. I will say that I'm not going to have time to go through our events and activities coming up, but you will find those as well as past shows on JamalaRogers.com. And the battlefield is coming up next. Just because we are totally becoming a police state, today is October 22nd, National Day Against Police Brutality, and we will be at Don Brown Chevrolet. That's at Kings Highway and Vandeventer. Why are we targeting Don Brown? Because Don Brown is a part of an illegitimate police commissioner, because they've taken away local control and the governor has appointed these people, all pro police. He also has the contract for the police cars. Shouldn't that be some kind of conflict? But no, it isn't. So he is going to, we'll be raising our issues in front of his business, Kings Highway and Vandeventer, at 4 p.m. today. Wear black. That's what I got on. Wear black. Thank you for listening. And Gihad's got on his black cap. And I will see you on the battlefield. Thank you.
Thanks, Jamala. Thanks, everybody.
Stand by. We've got to do it right. Stop the